That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year. As dawn broke over the Western Hemisphere, January 1, 1904, ushering in a new Christian year, a group of short-statured, intense, yellow-skinned men sat about a council table in Tokyo, Japan.
So, gentlemen, it is agreed then?
Oh, yes, it is agreed.
China must be protected. Protected against further aggression from the Caucasian race. Port Arthur is a most strategic harbor and must be wrested from the clutches of Russia. China is weak. Japan is strong. It is for Japan, therefore, to demand that Russia evacuate Port Arthur. Do you all agree?
Oh, yes, sir.
Then a diplomatic note to be forwarded to the Tsar by the Japanese ambassador in Moscow will be prepared at once.
Note after note sped between the two countries, the rest of the world viewing with growing apprehension the ever-weakening link of Russo-Japanese amity. Then, just as peace seemed assured, an unquestionable tone of menace appeared in the diplomatic dispatches of Japan. And on February 10, belated declarations of hostilities were announced. The Russo-Japanese War had begun. A successive march of major victories for the Nipponese led directly to the final siege of Port Arthur, with Japan's greatest strength of the war to date thrown into the conflict. Finally, on November 4, Russian General Stoizel, in command of Port Arthur, himself twice wounded, telegraphs the Tsar.
Position of citadel hopeless. Garrison reduced to almost last shell. All long-range guns destroyed or put out of action by Japanese. Cannot hold fortress. But we can die fighting for Russia. And we will. The citadel shall never be surrendered.
But on November 4, Port Arthur fell before the terrific onslaught. General Stoizel and his men with only 10 guns fled to Liao Ti Hill, leaving the Japanese in occupation of the harbor and city. Instigated by U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt, peace was negotiated the next year at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The following points decided. 1.
Russia must cede the half of Saghalien annexed in 1875.
2.
Russia must surrender her lease of the Kwantung Peninsula and Port Arthur.
3.
Russia must evacuate Manchuria.
4.
Russia must recognize Japan's sphere of influence in Korea.
Thus ended the 1904 battle for aggression in China. 1904, that was the year. June 16. The pleasure craft SS General Slocum, laden to the gunwales with more than 1,000 gay joyseekers, returns from a day's excursion up the East River. As the ship steams toward New York Harbor, reaches the foot of 138th Street.
Mike, I had a swell time today.
It was a Lollapalooza, all right.
Where's your brother?
Oh, he's probably out in the rear deck watching them dance.
Mike, don't you want we should dance for a while now?
Well, it's hunky-dory by me. Come on, kid.
Hey, wait a minute.
What's the matter?
Look, there.
Where?
What? Coming out of the cabin there.
What? Ah! Smoke!
It's a fire!
Fire! Fire! Fire! Fire! Fire! Fire!
Panic transformed the laughing crowd into a seething mass of screaming maniacs. Hundreds who were not pushed through the weakened rails jumped overboard, only to sink beneath the churning water weighted down by inadequate life preservers. Others, their clothing on fire, leaped to their deaths. Private yachts and commercial tugboats sped to the disaster, effected heroic rescues. But when the toll was taken, more than 900 lives had been forfeit. The six officers and directors of the Knickerbocker Steamship Company, owners of the General Slocum, were called upon to explain why the Slocum's life preservers were rotten, why the fire hose burst when subjected to pressure of the ship's pumps. That was the year
that the Dressmakers Protective Association declared,
"Corsets will always stay straight front as long as we shall live."
That was the year
that on the late evening of September 26, two men and two women stood giggling and nudging each other as they faced New York's magistrate Poole.
What are these people charged with, Officer Rensselaer?
Well, Your Honor, please, only one of them's charged. That's Mr. Norton there. And I'm charging him with disturbing the peace.
Circumstances of the arrest?
Well, sir, I was riding my beat. I'm a bicycle patrolman. When I come on these people riding in an auto and making lots of noise, that was down in Jefferson Market Court.
Go on.
Well, sir, I caught up with them and told them to be more quiet. When I did, they stuck out their tongues at me and blew smoke in my face, all of them, even the women. And the prisoner here, he called me a bobby. Now, nobody can call me a name like that, so I took him in.
Yes. A uniform must always be respected. Your fine, $2. Next case.
Say, copper. Patrolman Rensselaer. Would you like to make a statement for the press?
Well, yeah, don't mind if I do. You know, it's a terrible thing the way the women are smoking nowadays. There are hundreds of them on the avenue every night. Real society people. They blow smoke right out of their noses and make rings and inhale and everything. I know, because I followed them. They usually smoke a cigarette halfway down and then throw it away and light another. It's kind of funny, ain't it? But then I suppose it's fashionable.
1904, that was the year in the early autumn.
We are prepared to prove that Republican campaign funds for the forthcoming national election have been largely derived from the big Wall Street trusts. The Republican National Chairman, Mr. Cortelyou, used to be Secretary of Labor and Commerce. As a matter of fact, he just resigned in order to run the GOP campaign. And it was through fear that Mr. Cortelyou might reveal certain facts he learned while in the President's cabinet that the trusts are contributing to the Republican funds.
Such were the charges hurled by the Democratic National Headquarters, supporting Judge Alton B. Parker for President. Replied the incumbent candidate for the grand old party,
"The statements made by Mr. Parker are unqualifiedly and atrociously false. As Mr. Cortelyou has said to me more than once during this campaign, if elected, I shall go into the presidency unhampered by any pledge, promise, or understanding of any kind, sort, or description, save my promise made openly to the American people that so far as in my power lies, I shall see to it that every man has a square deal, no less and no more. Signed, Theodore Roosevelt."
But despite Democratic accusations and a delayed Rooseveltian reply, betting odds on the eve of election, November 7, were 5-1 in favor of Roosevelt. As hundreds of thousands of Americans prepared to storm the polls on the morrow, said Democrat Parker,
"I am confident of Democratic success."
Said Republican Roosevelt,
"My election is certain."
Polling a majority of Electoral College votes larger than the total number of votes for the Democratic candidates, Theodore Roosevelt and his vice presidential running mate were overwhelmingly elected. Following the election, T.R.'s official statement:
"I am deeply sensible of the honor done me by the American people in thus expressing their confidence in what I have tried to do. I appreciate to the full the solemn responsibility this confidence imposes upon me, and I shall do all that in my power lies not to forfeit it."
Thank you. 5th day of May, 1904, in the city of Prague, Bohemia, is a day of solemn beauty as a host of hatless men and women march slowly behind a flower-bedecked casket. Therein lies the mortal remains of one of the world's truly great modern composers, who but a few days before had known his first musical failure, the artistic collapse of an opera which he had hoped would be his final crown of success. During his 64 and a half years, there had been born of his genius such masterpieces as Humoresque, Symphony from the New World, Songs My Mother Taught Me. But this last failure proved too great a burden. And on this 5th day of May, the world mourned the passing of Antonín Dvořák. That was the year
that you were reading such bestsellers as The Little Shepherd of Kingdom Come by John Fox, Jr.
The Crossing by Winston Churchill.
Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm by Mrs. Kate Douglas Wiggin.
That was the year
that you were attending the theater to enjoy Richard Mansfield and Ivan the Terrible.
James K. Hackett in The Fortunes of the King.
Margaret Anglin in The Eternal Feminine.
And that was the year, 1904, that you were singing
Michael Kelly with his sweetheart came from County Cork, and there upon a holiday they landed in New York. They strolled around to see the sights, alas, it's sad to say, poor Kelly lost his little girl upon the Great White Way.
She walked uptown from Herald Square to 42nd Street. The traffic stopped as she cried to the copper on the beat.
Fifth Avenue, a band began to play. 10,000 men were marching, for it was St. Patrick's Day. The wearing of the green rang out upon the morning air. 'Twas Kelly's favorite song, so Mary said, I'll find him there.
She climbed up on the grandstand in hopes her might she'd see. 500 Kellys left the ranks in answer to her plea. Has anybody here seen Kelly? K-E-double-L-Y. Has anybody here seen Kelly? Have you seen him smile? Sure his hair is red, his eyes are blue, and he's Irish through and through. Has anybody here seen Kelly? Kelly from the Emerald Isle.